Today, we have a special episode. Simon just published a 113-page report on the state of fintech in 2025. If you love charts and you want to go deep on the biggest trends and why they matter, then this is for you. We talk about how hyperscalers like Robinhood, Revolut, and others are starting to take on the big banks. We talk about AI and how it unlocks 90% of the $30 trillion market for financial services. We talk about the wallet wars and who's going to win. Is it Apple, Google, Visa, or someone else entirely? And that's really just the tip of the iceberg. I think my big takeaway and reflection from this conversation is seeing how in 2025, fintech is really only just getting started, but you can see how we're at the cusp of a lot of really exciting changes. So I think you're really going to enjoy this conversation. Let's dive in. Simon, you're looking pretty amazing considering you just dropped a 113-page slide deck on the state of fintech in 2025.
I'm feeling pretty amazing, and thank you so much to Jeff for being like an absolute hero and helping us get through this. The guys at Aperture and, of course, Sardine for giving me the space to do this, because this was, I'm not going to lie, a fun one to put together. I'm excited for going through it with you, Rex, and you might even spot a couple of things that you mentioned when we were draft reviewing it right at the end. Some Rex comments made it in there for sure.
I love it. Well, I'm excited. This is going to be kind of a special extended version of Rex and Simon Talk FinTech, where we're basically going to walk through the slide and the trends. We've got a whole bunch of stuff to unpack. Trends, FinTech XAI, banks, embedded FinTech, the scandemic, list goes on. But why don't you just take us up from the top and kick us off with the main and biggest trends.
So welcome to the state of FinTech 2025. And the state of FinTech is good. We are in the age of the FinTech hyperscaler. Yes, we have Nubank over 100 million customers, Klarna at 85 million, and Revolut. Yes, those guys snapping at the heels. And I think the infrastructure is shifting. We are seeing those hyperscalers coming after the incumbents, and for the first time, they're threatened. So today, we're going to talk about the broader trends, fintech and AI, embedded finance, some of the banks, because hey, they're still around, neobanks, payments, open finance, big tech and wallets, stable coins, because they're a thing this year, and of course, the scamdemic. So let's get to it, Rick.
Grab a coffee, a cocktail, get away from the kids for the holidays, go into some dark hole and just listen to the soothing tones of Simon talk for FinTech for the next hour or two.
I hope you interrupt me a lot more than that, because it there's only so much I can listen to one voice, especially my own. Goodness. All right, let's do this. So the biggest trend is the FinTech hyperscaler. These are fundamentally companies who can be bigger than the incumbents by some margin. You know, when you think about hyperscalers, you're thinking about Microsoft and Amazon and all of those guys. Stripe, could they be that? Nubank, could they be that? But for retail, well, yeah, these are not small numbers. They're on the way to $100 billion market caps in some cases, and they're continuing to grow. So this is going to be fascinating to watch, as fintech is only 3% finished. We only have 3% market share, and the market narrative has really shifted. It's crazy how now like fintech is back as a consensus, because for us who are fans of the space, it should never have really gone away. Maybe it was overbought in 2021. But if you look at the publicly traded stocks, they're all heading back up and they're all doing pretty well.
And yeah. And I think with that, I love the first slide on the hyperscalers. So framing, you know, financial services revenue, $30 trillion market. Fintechs have only captured like 1%. One of the biggest, most successful incumbents, let's say a Visa, is like a $500 billion company. What you're looking at right now is a slide of companies with about $200 billion in combined market cap. So altogether, not as big as JP Morgan Chase, but they're really just getting started. And so to your point, these hyperscalers, could one of them, and there's some other ones not even on this slide that are, you know, north of $30 billion companies, could one of them be as big as Visa? Not in 2025, but in the next 5 years? And that's on the menu in a way that wasn't before.
I think that's the big moment. That's the market shift, and growth rate matters, and we'll come back to that point. But it's not just about how big are you, it's how fast are you growing. And absolutely, we know that those growth rates are going to continue to matter if they can be sustained.
You've got a 35% TPV CAGR for Stripe, you know? It's going to be very hard to grow that fast going forward, given where they are. But there are opportunities.
Right. How long could you keep that up for? I mean, JP Morgan's doing 15%. So if they can stay ahead of that number for long enough, they're doing pretty well. I think this is going to be the next big trend of 2025 and six is the IPO windows open. Klarna and Chime have laid their cards on the table saying, you know, that they're looking to go for it. But who's next? I think that's going to be interesting because it starts to change the perception of fintech in the eyes of the broader investment market, and it recycles capital back into the ecosystem. We need those stories.
And it's the trickle started, right? We talked about Bridget selling for $460 million to a public company. Moneyline, already public, but got acquired for another for $1 billion. Stripe made their largest ever acquisition, Bridge, also $1 billion. So these are trickles. These aren't, you know, massive IPOs, but these are chunky outcomes. And that builds confidence towards maybe unleashing the fintech IPO flood wave or breaking the dam. So we'll see.
That one acquisition has probably made stablecoins the hottest category, if not the second hottest category in all of finance right now. It's crazy how that happens. Neobanks on a pure customer basis are now as big as some of the biggest banks, if you just look at their pure customer numbers. And they are just opening up to cross-selling. Historically, viewed with a very US-centric perspective, neobanks were ultra low cost, ultra low revenue per customer. But that's not the case when you look at Nubank or Revolut and you look outside the US. I mean, look, Kazakhstan's Kaspi is listed on NASDAQ. You've probably never heard of this company, but this is a stock trading at a $21 billion market valuation. Outside the US, these companies are massive and meaningful market takers. So I think looking at this as a Brit, looking at it internationally, it's a different conversation.
Yeah. You didn't used to be able to see these on the same Y-axis as, say, like a Bank of America or JP Morgan, but at least on the consumer banking, you know, Bank of America has 38 million monthly actives. They have, you know, over 100 million customers total. Nubank has 100 million customers, 91 million monthly actives. So like these companies, like they're showing up on the Y-axis. And again, maybe headed above some of the big guys.
And they've got time. You know, like some of them are already profitable and they've got time. The big trend of the year that I've seen is that international expansion is now something these hyperscalers are looking to grow their muscle in. And if you look at what really unlocked the cloud service providers, it was how many regions are you in? You know, Satya Nadella talks about they're in 60 data residency markets. That's a hard infrastructure to build. But Robinhood's launching in Europe. Affirm now is. And this is a crazy stat. 40 million of Revolut's customers are based outside of its home market. Really, really crazy. You see this a lot with Klarna as well. Companies that started in a smaller country that go on to larger ones and do well. And we've seen as well, you know, JP Morgan are planning to expand into continental Europe now. So this is not just a fintech thing. That international expansion is a massive trend to watch in the next 12 months.
Yeah, you're probably more bullish on Europeans expanding to the US than I am.
Well, so here's the thing that happens. Once a European expands into the US and does it successfully, they just become a US company and nobody thinks of them as European. Because you use Spotify and don't think it's European, and you use Klarna and you don't think it's European. If you know it is, then you think about that later. Wise as well. You just think it's that company that I use. So that's the trick to pull off here, is you don't brand as European. Without question, this was the year of Gen AI in finance. Everybody has a story, but very few have real value capture, especially in the incumbents. The amount of death by sort of PowerPoint and Pilot is unbelievable. But, you know, Klarna talking about their chatbot that does the work of 700 agents just created the massive PR value. And there are a few examples where it's really working and lots of examples where it's really not. We talked a little bit earlier about Bridge's acquisition, but this is the tip of the iceberg of payments companies getting really serious about this space. Just a couple of days ago, we saw Nuvei's now doing direct settlement to merchants in stablecoins. I've seen three stablecoin-based neobanks this week. It's become a really hot category. And the payments world has gone from no never to how quickly can I get this? That shift is dramatic. Embedded finance, great slide from BCG. Still the single fastest growing net new opportunity despite the bad mood music. And of course, 2024 was the year the wallet wars began. When Apple was forced to open up NFC in Europe, it then decided it was going to open up NFC access. And if you're not familiar with NFC, near field communication is how they do the tap to pay. But it's also how you tap to enter a sports stadium. It's also how you authenticate passports. Sometimes there's a whole bunch of things that becomes unlocked just from that one piece. And now, whether it's Pays or Google or PayPal, it's open season for who gets to be your wallet. And that's going to be a major trend.
Two things here. One is now every iPhone is a payment terminal because it can receive a tap-to-pay payment. The other thing is every payment terminal, well, not every, but a large percentage of them now accept tap-to-pay. And in a way that you couldn't before, I've been going around just using only my Apple Watch. And so that, between Apple and Google, to your point, the wallet wars, like things are moving on to these digital platforms where it's not high enough. Like, oh, I have to get out my card. I have to swipe it. And that's going to have implications. Europe's huge. Been ahead of us, so I know that's not, you know.
Yes and no. I think we'll come to the open finance story, but in a lot of ways, yes, and in a lot of ways, no. Like, we adopted it first, but did we adopt it best? TBD. So this is my big story is, like, look, the last 10 years unbundled the simpler products, sometimes lower revenue, sometimes lower margin. It was mostly debit cards, not credit. It was mostly financial inclusion, not the prime customer segment. We did a little bit of, you know, digital-only banks and spend management. We did some mobile brokerage. But was it disrupting that sweet spot, that heartland? You know, maybe not. But I think that's really shifted. The wallet wars and open finance mean we are seeing the great rebundling of finance. Nowhere's that more evident than with somebody like a Robinhood. And yes, they started as the stock trading app, but now they're so much more than that. They're taking over somebody's entire retirement, their savings, their IRA, their credit card with the X1 card. This is meaningful rebundling that you're starting to see. And I think that will become much more common as well in the commercial space as the ramps, the Brexes, and everybody else starts to rebundle.
I think it's hard to overstate how important this is to watch. You know, FinTech, when it started, they came for little table scraps. And now they're showing up for the main meal. To your point about Robinhood, great case study. Free trading, average account balance years ago was in the hundreds of dollars. Now it's about $5,000, but they did their match program and the average balance coming in via match is $81,000. So that moves you very clearly from like the customers that banks don't care about into the mass affluent. So that's going from the scraps to the dinner table, and that's where you start to feel pressure on the incumbents. And that is going to be so interesting. And that happened this year, right? The match transfer program, Robinhood doing card. But there are lots of other examples outside of just a Robinhood.
Completely. And then the second thing was this kind of home turf, the core of a lot of the big banks was their global corporate franchise, their institutional franchise. That was safe space. That was never going to be threatened because it was too complex. But AI is attacking those complex workflows and reducing the cost of doing them. And that has two opportunities. One, reducing the cost for the incumbent, but reducing the cost to be a disruptor in that space. And I think that's going to be really interesting to watch. Complex KYB, private credit analysis, equities analysis, all of those workflows suddenly become much more achievable. So should we do fintech and AI?
We should. I feel like we did enough just with the trends, but yeah, fintech and AI. Let's do it.
All right. Yeah. Where we've covered it in the trends, I'll try and skip through it a little bit, but the application layer, I think we can now agree is booming. It was always the initial meme was, you know, does everything end up at the chip manufacturers and the foundation models? Far from it. There are companies generating revenue across the entire value chain. And if you double click on financial services, every bank employee has an AI agent equivalent. These were just the logos I found trying to quickly put together a slide. And, you know, not every logo fits in every category perfectly. But whether it's, you know, sort of your front end developers or your customer communications or your engineers or your compliance workflows, there's a company that's doing Gen AI in that category, but doing the labor piece of it, doing what the humans had to do and the software couldn't.
Yeah, and that's, let's talk about the labor and human versus software. And this is playing out everywhere with AI. But in financial services, $30 trillion market, most of that gets spent on humans, call it $27 trillion. So, and your software spend, it's like sub $1 trillion a year. Right, it's hard to break out because a lot of these are proprietary systems. With AI, you can actually attack the labor part of the category. So the market for what can be done by software is way bigger than it used to be. And so that is now on the table too. And now whether or not price point collapses if you replace a, you know, compliance agent or to what extent it does, we're going to find out. But it means so much more of the work being done in financial services can now be pushed into software.
100%. So there's a few incumbents that have got into production with Gen AI, but it's by exception. I mean, these were the two I found. There are probably others, but this is like a slice of what they do versus like a Klarna who says that they are sort of pretty much shutting down most of their large software as a service providers to replace them, and that they're not hiring anymore because AI is now doing so much for them. And that fundamentally comes from the fact that they've done the hard work on having the data science and the software capability to get the advantage from AI, and most incumbents just don't have that setup in the first place, so they're a long way from being able to use it, and it just takes them longer to kind of execute. So they're left in a very different space.
Another way of articulating it, if you look at incumbents, specifically banks, probably the metric that AI relates to best that you might be able to observe is expense ratio. What percentage of your revenue gets spent on expenses generating that revenue? And a good expense ratio is 50%. It's half of your revenue goes out the door to like people. And a lot of, I think it's about 60% on average. So to what extent can the incumbents pull that down? Well, right now they haven't. Like, you know, you've got the Morgan Stanleys, the BBVAs who've done like a little bit of work. Maybe we're going to start to show that up. But if you looked at, you know, the equivalent, and it's not apples to apples, of an expense ratio for Klarna, and they said, oh, we just reduced our customer service staff by 2/3, they're moving way faster into that implementation, as are some of these other scale or hyperscalers, as you called them.
And so pace of change is a power law. Pace of revenue growth is a power law. Those who can adopt fastest, can adapt fastest, will grow fastest, and they'll make a meaningful difference and begin to pull away. And I think this inflection point in the age of the fintech hyperscaler is really just supercharged by AI. So it's one thing to be able to get something to production. It's another thing to pivot your entire organization around a technology.
Yeah. If you feel like you've fallen asleep with fintech, like wake up in 2025, because it's going to be exciting.
It really is. And the thing as a nerd for capital markets that really excites me is this was the untouched. You were never going to get near Wall Street. You know, it's just too complex. The jargon's too deep. It's too wide. And yet private credit and equities workflows, you can now make a meaningful difference to those workflows. The sort of entry-level team of analyst stuff, Gen AI is going to get you a lot of the ways, and there's a lot of people in production with this. In fact, the fastest adopters are the hedge funds and the buy-side firms and the private credit funds. They're making a real difference. So this is kind of not like a consumer app that everybody is relatable for, but it's what really runs the world of the financial markets, and that's where it's going to rubber hits the road. So I love this use case as well, which is I don't think anybody's thinking enough about what happens when there's an agent sitting inside my phone and I ask it, you know, hey, Google, please book me a flight to Antarctica for $300. And it goes, okay, processing your request. I'm pulling your information out of your secure on-device wallet because Apple's made that available. I'm finding you a flight. Okay, I found this one. Would you like me to pay for it? Yes. And all I've said is yes. And then it pays for it using the credential that's on my device. And then it stores the booking inside of my wallet. And I've got the tickets sitting right there. You want that user journey. I want that user journey. But why would that agent select Robinhood versus Chase versus somebody else? Because if that happens, really these LLMs, these AI agents are starting to make a real meaningful difference to market share. And who's going to lean into that trend, I think, is going to be interesting to watch. And then how do they make payments? There's a whole bunch of stuff that we can go into there. I'm going to skip a couple of slides just in the interest of time, because there's plenty to cover off in embedded finance. Let's just jump into this.
And embedded finance is a broad category.
It is. You can be embedding insurance in a travel website, and it's technically embedded finance, right? Finance that shows up at the point of need is like a broad category. But typically when fintech people say it, they mean like debit or credit programs using a bank under the hood, but appearing in some software platform or a fintech company. And of course, we saw the blow up from Synapse, and that caused some consumer harm and reputation issues. But we also saw, because this space scaled so massively, there was a regulatory pushback and a lot of consent orders, which meant people weren't opening accounts and they weren't onboarding new programs. And then there's a rise in enforcement actions, and then just a real drop off in new fintech companies coming. And of course, this does follow fintech funding as much as it follows enforcement actions, but you take those two things together, and it was pretty rapid decline.
The thing that you know, this is mostly a funding chart, but it's correlated with the number of fintech programs launching at BaaS platforms. That's hard to observe because you don't get the same kind of publicly available data. But, you know, anecdotally, I can share that, like, yes, the number of net new programs being launched by BaaS platforms, providers, banks has gone way down.
Well, and we saw Marqeta say that the scrutiny has doubled the amount of days it takes to launch programs from 150 to 300. But I think Max Levchin nailed it, which is, look, this is almost like a coming of age thing. You go through regulatory scrutiny, and if you make it through that, you get to be a big company. You get to be a big part of the industry. So the difficult teenage phase turns into, hey, I've left college, I've got a job, life is hard now, but these are the practical realities. But look, this is still lucrative. If you make it through it and you're a smaller bank and you've exited your consent orders and you've staffed up on compliance, then look, you were talking about cost income ratios. Bancorp's running around 41%, which is way better than the 50% and way better than the average of 60%. And year-on-year revenue growth, high return on equity, good return on assets. These are the benchmarks that matter if you're a smaller company.
A good ROA for a bank is like 1%, and you've got Pathward there at, you know, 2.2%. Doesn't sound like much, but when you realize it's more than double the industry, it's quite good. And that's true for all the, you know, ROE, ROA numbers for the platform banks.
Indeed. So let's talk about banks a little bit, because they're still here, and they had a great year. They outperformed the S&P 500, and there's a lot of doing that. Like, deposit repricing's normalized, investment banking fees are back, credit card loan balances continue to rise, base rates are still high, and the US economy's been roaring. And heck, it's even been a good time to be in a European bank, which 5 years ago would have been the worst thing in the world. So, you know, they're feeling comfortable. And I think that's a dangerous place to be, is feel comfortable as an incumbent, given what's coming. But what this does, hopefully, is free up some space for investing in the future and really transforming how you do things. So deposit flight has ended. But what's fascinating is consistently JP Morgan is the one that zigs when everybody else zags. They're betting on international expansion. They're betting on adding branches when everybody else is closing it. And it's been interesting to see PNC's now followed that. I think you can also say that investment banking fees are following a kind of a pickup in overall markets activity. And if markets do continue to pick up through 2025, you can expect those to come back. So it's a pretty good time to be an incumbent bank at the moment if you were going to invest. Because private credit is probably the big game in town. If you're a bank CEO, that's the thing that's kind of going after your core heartland lending into the commercial space. So Citi and Goldman and JP Morgan and SocGen, they're all partnering to try and get into that private credit space. And, you know, we've talked about doing an entire show on that because it's a fascinating topic. And, you know, with a new administration, are we going to see that the Basel III rules are lighter or not implemented at all? Are we going to see that they're loosened a little bit in Europe? This could make banks more profitable in time. And then there's really the ever-present threats, which are now still absolutely true and getting a lot worse. The quiet part out loud is we're in a scamdemic and everybody's worried about fraud risk, like everybody. And there's just real effort under the surface to deal with that. And of course, FedNow just makes it 10 times worse. But I think this is the key
stuff about why they've done well is macroeconomic oriented, because they're highly correlated to that. One of the things we were concerned about was, are we going to have a hard landing, go into recession? And it seems like that has been priced down, so they've been able to do well. But then there are some of these more kind of, you know, banking specific trends around even the scandemic. And I want to also call out JP Morgan. I think they've done a great job for some of their infrastructure stuff. If there's one bank's developer platform that I hear from founders I've backed, they're like, I want to use this thing, it's JP Morgan. You can go to, and I've got it pulled up here, developer.payments.jpmorgan, and they say we have API docs, and you can go and you can see their API docs, and you can see what products they have. They have checkout, they have global payments, they have online payments. Probably the one I hear about the most from entrepreneurs is they want access to JPM's global payments capability. And so I just want to give them a shout out in terms of actually getting, you know, developer docs up online, showing up, having like a head of developer relations. That seems to be interesting. If anyone has a chance of, you know, capturing a decent amount of volume from some of the fintechs, I think they're pretty well positioned to do so.
If we ever end up with the polar ice caps melting and it turns into the movie Waterworld, where you've got to find the high ground for like any land and everybody lives on boats, JP Morgan would be the last incumbent standing, because they have definitely done the right things consistently that you would do as an incumbent.
Jamie says he hates blockchain, but I see on their dev portal blockchain deposit account balances and their API registry. So they're not completely sleeping on it.
Oh, far from it. But I think the punchline from this section is the unbundling has led to a fragmentation, because yes, they're still in place for a consumer, but most consumers are now using three or more apps, one in five is using a lot more, and the unbundling happened and the rebundling has started, and the banks are having to spend billions and billions to try and keep up, and they're not necessarily marketing where a consumer is watching. I haven't found a bank on YouTube yet, but I'll find plenty of Robinhood and the creator ecosystem that lives around Robinhood on there, and many others. So what should the banking app of tomorrow look like? Maybe a Revolut, Robinhood, Nubank are kind of interesting examples of what rebundling does look like for the future. So that leads me neatly onto our friends at the neobanks. And as mentioned, retail banking is massive. LATAM has Nubank.
Out of the incumbent banking landscape onto the neobanks.
Welcome to the neobank world. Retail banking is massive. And it's growing. LATAM has Nubank. Europe has Revolut. Where's that for the US? Well, maybe it's Nubank themselves. They are in the Americas and they're looking to do international expansion. Maybe it's Revolut. They have a stated strategy now of getting a license, a charter, as quickly as possible when they enter a market. They've just got one in Mexico. They've just secured one, I think, in Dubai or the UAE. They will potentially show up. And I've countered against Revolut multiple times. I've been a naysayer and they keep proving me wrong. So I would not bet against these guys to get a charter in the US and become a massive company in the US at some point. They're not going away and they're just going to keep going. And
maybe
because
it's Robinhood moving into more banking. They have high yield credit card doing the asset transfers. Maybe it's Chime. Maybe they're maybe able to move up market. Yeah, maybe it's a Cash App or a Venmo with new leadership under Alex Chris, or SoFi, you know, has been doing some acquisitions and expanding there. So we've got a lot of people.
And SoFi kind of goes after that more prime lending base because they start with the student refinancing, but that kind of follows the Gen Y folks that they got as their first cohort. They're wrapping other products around them. I think that's going to be, yeah, they could they become the hyperscaler? Could Cash App now go and get a charter? Will we go look at the Bank Holding Company Act under a new administration? Will that start to change what people are doing? Will we see the OCC starts granting new charters? Does that change the conversation? Will it be Robinhood, as you say? You know, we've seen MoneyLion's been acquired, but the financial inclusion space is bigger than a niche, but it's probably not the prime segments that the banks really care about. Chime, they're on the way to IPO, but then they're not trying to compete with Chase. Still, will they get a charter? And I think this is the big story for this section. Will Affirm go get a charter? Because Klarna has one in Sweden, and it gives them a different type of balance sheet. So who's going to get charters? And then will that go after the heartland?
Klarna launched a credit card. Yeah, so you've got all these people who are, you know, waiting in the wings to move in against the banks. I'll also call
I want to
upgrade the founder of Lending Club, Renaud LaPlanche. His new company is, you know, 5-6 years old now, originating $10 billion a year and growing. You know, the pandemic set them back a little bit, but they're in a great position. You've also got one, which is Walmart and Ribbit Pact, which, you know, Walmart has some absurd amount. It's something like 30 million Americans interact with Walmart on a monthly basis. Massive distribution channel, not something you hear about a lot in the press, but where could that be in 3 years? So there are a lot of people who can scale dramatically in a way
and
that wasn't after true it. Recently.
And I want to give a shout out to the guys at Wise who don't get a lot of attention, but now, really, if you look at them, are moving a meaningful amount of cross-border volume. You know, Citibank is the behemoth, the biggest money center bank in the world, and Wise is moving a serious amount of money across borders. They've got 7.2 million customers, 500,000 small businesses. But here's the thing I didn't know. They have 92 banks. So if you are a smaller bank, if you are a neobank, using Wise for the infrastructure actually makes a lot of sense for cross-border. So the unbundling and the rebundling is the theme that enables the hyperscalers to sort of happen. And then, of course, payments.
And for
payments,
smaller banks, partnering with fintechs might be their best way to take on the big five banks. If you look at a lot of community credit unions, they're not going to build Wise in-house. But if you look at a lot of their net outflows, especially for ones that focus on certain demographics and populations, there can be a lot of remittances. And you should probably integrate and like support that natively, and Wise will help you do that.
So speaking of payments, JP Morgan is still the 900-pound gorilla. They are massive. They're continuing to grow, and processing payments for Amazon really, really helps. However, Amazon now also process with Stripe and with Adyen, who are growing faster. So if this was a straight race, then past the finish line, if we ended it here today, JP Morgan, no contest. Hands down, they win. But if you play this forward a decade, then what does this chart start to look like with those growth rates? And I think that's going to be the big story for payments. Is it's an all out fist fight for market share at this point. Now, Stripe, what makes them special is because they are indexed to growth companies, those companies become massive enterprise clients incredibly quickly. So they get this spike in volume. So 82% of tracked AI companies by Andreessen are Stripe customers already. OpenAI is on track for $3.7 billion of revenue in 24 and will do 11.6 in 25. That's a massive client that started as a tiny little thing.
Yeah. That what is that at of total for the previous charts, like 1% or something? To go from 0 to 1% of like the entire payment processing of JP Morgan in 1 year for a new customer is pretty crazy.
It's wild, isn't it? Adyen has gone to in-store. So these were not they used to be the e-commerce providers, but now they're going after Toast, Shift4, and Square. Adyen is now bigger on the in-store POS volume than a Shift4 or a Toast. What does that mean for that sweet spot of like the sort of in-store checkout? So they're coming for that too, and Stripe's just launched its terminal. So I think there's a haves and a have-not reality of like who's growing and who's growing payment volume. And the difference is your technology stack. Do you have a single API or multiple platforms? Do you have that uniform offering across in-store and online or not? Do you support everything through the same platform? And can you grow via direct sales, or is M&A your only way to grow? These are just fundamentally different businesses. And so you want to... Getting to where these hyperscalers are is very, very difficult. They're now at a point where their tech platforms enables them to grow faster. Big story of the year, accelerated checkouts. I don't know if you've used ShopPay or if you've seen Fastlane in the wild or Apple Pay, but you have to support this, and traditional acquirers typically don't. It's the year of the accelerated checkout.
Apple Pay, Google Pay on mobile work incredibly well. Shop Pay works incredibly well. Like all of these, accelerated checkouts are doing great. Link, I'm seeing Link show up a lot more.
Yeah, exactly. It's an accelerated checkout, but it also supports Pay by Bank, that they can connect into that as well. So this was crazy. Stripe Link represents nearly a half of the outgoing traffic from Stripe.com, which means that if you're hitting a checkout page, half of that is hitting the accelerated checkout. It's just wild.
And Plaid Stripe has a big part to play in that in terms of helping connect those bank accounts and making it frictionless for folks to plug in multiple payment credentials. Especially,
it's going to be interesting to watch PayPal in the next year as well, because they didn't necessarily shock the world, but my goodness, did they get their mojo back. So they're not necessarily as profitable as they used to be, but they are pushing in a big way. Look, they became an alternative processor for Shopify. That was the banner Stripe client, is now processing with Adyen and with PayPal. And those are sort of your big three of the hyperscalers. And then, of course, if we're in payments, let's not forget that Visa and MasterCard, they did settle an antitrust suit, but they might have more coming. So the card networks, they've got their own battles to fight at this point, especially with an administration that looks after small businesses maybe a little bit more and might come back after that space. And of course, Capital One, potentially with Discover, could be in the conversation. Let's talk about open finance if you get to dive into that one.
Let's do it. And all these things are related, right? Because part of what's powering all the payments and all of the wallets there are the developments around open finance and open banking.
And I think open banking has found its killer app. Like, it used to be nice that it was you could sign up a little bit faster and you could do some fraud checks because you had kind of accelerated KYC because you could pull existing information through. But really, payments is where it's happening, and you're seeing Pay by Bank in the wild. And of course, payments are getting the real-time payments rail. There is RTP that's been around for some time, but FedNow is rapidly growing. Look at that quarterly growth. Real-time payments are going to be a reality in the US very, very quickly. And of course, if you look at Europe, it took a little while, but you see it in the data now. This is a major part of what makes open banking is the payments experience. And what happens if you start to decouple the payments rail from the line of credit? In Brazil, in India, it's now common for Pay by Bank to be the rail for a line of credit. So rather than having a credit card, I'd have a credit wallet and I'd pay via FedNow. Like, that would be disruptive to a Visa and MasterCard.
That's pretty profound. It's a little confusing, so maybe we'll just anchor on what that means. You know, right now you have a bank account and you have a credit card, but they're different systems. You know, even just payment, if you pay from one to the other, it takes a long time to show up, days. A bank account is a credit product, right? You can overdraft your bank account. Now, usually you can't overdraft it more than $25 or $50 or something like that, and you get charged a fee, so you don't want to. But there's no reason why you can't, on top of one of these payment rails, like a Pix or a UPI, build out something that's more of a true credit product. And the reason it's profound is because, now you have something that can start to compete with the Visas and the MasterCards in these new kind of real-time native banking ecosystems on top of ego banking. So that's, or on top of open banking. So that's going to be interesting to see how that works. Now, will that happen in the US anytime soon? Probably not. But these models might start working abroad, and you know, we've got our own.
Well, and if you're thinking on a 10-year time horizon as the hyperscalers are, you're going to be looking at this and you're going to be experimenting, and it might not catch fire. It might, but you're going to try. And so if Pay by Bank does start to challenge the card dominance, don't expect Visa and MasterCard to take that lane down. They've got their play, and they'll come for it for sure. But the US, welcome to the world of having open finance regulation. You got yourself a 1033. And I do think there was some good stuff. But the big issue here, in whether it's the US or Europe, is there's no upside for the banks. And because of that, everything's going to get slow walked. Use cases are not going to get supported. It's going to continue to be stuck in the mud as a consumer experience, not as good as cards until there's an incentive mechanism. So I think we can learn a lot from how the cards have an incentive mechanism through interchange. But what we get with open finance is way more data about a payment, and way more opportunities to build better consumer experiences. So the ideal future is I've got a wallet that stores all of my credentials, I've got real-time payments rails, and I've got a genuine alternative to cards. And we've talked a lot about wallets today, so I'm going to skip this section briefly because I think there's a couple of other things
I want to. It's really tied into the open banking story and the payment story. It's that you have all these trends coming together to make wallets more powerful and frictionless.
They become the center.
For Android and Apple, that's working. The payment terminals, everything's tap to pay. Oh, and your phone is a payment terminal, and you have
the great rebundling of the consumer's financial life will happen inside the wallet without question. So stable coins are having a renaissance. Stable coins were a big deal a few years ago, and then they felt like they weren't that stable when Terra Luna happened, but now we've realized that most of them are treasuries backed and people like them. And that shifted the vibe in crypto dramatically over the last 3 years. I mean, 2022, we were talking about FTX and crypto crash and Elizabeth Warren's anti-crypto army. And now we have banks in Europe who are issuing stablecoins and doing repo facilities on a public blockchain. We got a new US administration. So this means institutions and even banks can start to move forward and feel more confident about moving into the space. But the payments companies are leading. So
like you snuck in the Gary Gensler open to work in the top right there.
It's the meme that just won't die, and nor should it. But the Stripe acquisition of Bridge, you know, really got everybody excited. But the questions that always come up are, you know, isn't this just for trading and bots? And isn't it just kind of not really about the supply? And, you know, people are buying the stable coins, but that's not payments volume. But there's a lot of apples to oranges data. So the best thing when you double click on it is look at some of the Visa data about they estimate that there are $677 billion of adjusted transaction volume using kind of the stablecoin rail across 2024. It's not the biggest rail in the world, but its growth rate certainly is definitely there. And remittance flows, look at that chart. You know, you're sort of getting over 100 million per month and extrapolate that growth rate and it would go well. You can't assume the growth rate will extrapolate. You could say it could all go horribly wrong. There are a bunch of caveats, but don't forget that SpaceX does treasury management. USAID is doing disbursements. Nigerian consumers are holding USD all through stablecoins. These things aren't going away. And this one is possibly my favorite slide in the whole deck because we are now finally seeing the institutional payments where global corporates are making cross-border payments using a stablecoin. So imagine I'm in Kenya and I'm importing oil from the Middle East. What I would do historically is do that via SWIFT, and it might take me 2 weeks. And then there's money, there's oil on a ship, and there's payments, and these things are completely disconnected. What stablecoins give me is the ability to automate all of that if I have a bank that would take the stablecoin messaging and the stablecoin layer as settlement and do the underlying settlement on its books and records on its systems. And there are banks out there doing this. This is not a crazy idea that you could buy oil with stablecoins. It is happening. And it's not all a bad thing. In fact, most of it is just because it's a better cross-border rail. The vast majority of this is legitimate. It's been fully sanctions checked. It's legitimate trade.
SWIFT's amazing way to let 80s mainframes communicate with each other across multiple hops to send international wires. There's no reason why we need to keep using it to do global payments.
Indeed. I think SWIFT is one of the most threatened by stablecoins by far. Good time to launch a podcast all about stablecoins, available wherever you get your podcasts now.
This is Simon's podcast, I should add. You should check it out, tokenized.
Wherever you get your podcast, guys. The Scamdemic. I think this is going to be another big theme for 2025. We lost over $1 trillion to scams in 2023, according to the Global Anti-Scam Alliance. 70% of those go unreported, and the loss per capita in the US is $3,250, which is absolutely crazy. It's absolutely massive.
That's crazy. Is that the actual amount scammed, or does that include all the compliance? Probably bakes in, which would be the fair way of calculating that, but it is a pretty
It's all in.
And one thing on the scams, you know, we talk a lot about replacing interchange or Visa or MasterCard, but they insure consumers against this, right? And so if we're going to move into a real-time payments rail, it's not just figuring out incentives and rewards. It's also figuring out all of these questions about if someone does get scammed, who pays for it. Zelle got hammered for this.
What's the reimbursement? And I'll come to the reimbursement methodology in a second. But the other thing that's happened in this space is deepfakes at KYC are up something like 2,000%. It's crazy. Now, it's from a low base. But the problem with deepfakes is they're so cheap. They're so easy to do. There's a report I saw earlier today that something like 50% or 45% of scams are now AI generated. It's just crazy. And you can beat most KYC with even liveness detection. So if I'm holding up my phone and doing a liveness detection, the deepfake can beat that too. You know, Sardine, we've done it with... we can KYC as Tom Cruise to most institutions around the world quite easily with a deepfake. And it's crazy how much of a leaky bucket this is, because that's our most important protection for the entire financial system.
And if you think you might be getting scammed, always get off the phone and reconnect with that person. I had a founder recently, you know, a sophisticated individual gets a call and it sounds like it's his mother's voice in the background. She's been kidnapped. And they're demanding payment. And so then the only reason it didn't actually end up sending the payment was he texted his dad and was like, oh, that's not actually
crazy, isn't it?
But like, you get like, this stuff is insane. Like, it will trick you. Like, this stuff is getting very good and adversarial.
So scams reimbursement framework, right? Like, look, we have a reimbursement framework in the UK where we did a 50-50 liability split. But that's not necessarily the most thoughtful approach. In the US, there's active litigation in the Southern District of New York to look at, you know, how does Reg E and Reg Z apply to scams? And there are major private sector efforts underway to try and deal with scams. But there's also going to be a lot of finger-pointing lawsuits and lawfare to get through before consumers are made whole. But if I would point at the Singaporean model as being, you know, kind of a mechanism to look at. I'm not going to go into it here. Hopefully, guys, you can check out the report and reach out to me if you want to know why I think this is better than what the UK did. But I think it's going to become a global trend that there's not just institutions trying to react to the scams, but there's also a real goal to try and kind of put laws in place. And then, look, it probably hasn't escaped you that TD Bank received a $3 billion fine for AML violations. The top largest fines in bank history all come for AML, and they all come for failures. And the amount of sanctions alerts that have happened in the past 2 years related to just Russia alone are up 816%. If you work in compliance, you are absolutely overwhelmed right now with all of this stuff. It's crazy how much there is. And frankly, that avalanche of alerts, you're not going to fix it by hiring more staff. This is where the AI model of software displacing some labor is the most pressing by far, and you need agents that can work alerts like we do at Sardine, or agents that can do KYB, or agents that can really just help with some of the lift, even if it's not kind of all of it. So sorry to leave it on a bummer, but I do think that as we get into next year, yes, scams become the biggest issue, but we're also going to see banks getting charters, fintech stocks do well, more M&A, wallets, and of course, some regulatory clarity for crypto. Hopefully you guys enjoyed this. I know I kind of blasted through it a little bit. It's a long old report, 113 pages. But if you appreciated it, I appreciate it if you check it out and get in touch if I can help you then. And Rex, what are your takeaways from kind of all of this?
I think my big takeaway is, like, where are we in the current technology implementation cycle in financial services? And I think we're getting to the end of the beginning. So if you think about where fintech started 15 years ago, it's like, come for the scraps. Now, 10, 15 years later, it's like, these hyperscalers are looking to actually come after incumbents and create whole new product bundles. So that's the end of the beginning, right? That's not a fait accompli. They have a lot more work. Of those 10-ish hyperscalers, maybe, probably half of them aren't going to be very successful or more. Like, not all 10 of them are going to be worth more than Visa. But now you can see a world in which 1, 2, 3 are, right? Maybe someone's worth more than JP Morgan. So that's the end of the beginning. And then I think the other part about the end of the beginning is all of these just individual kind of platform shifts, regulatory shifts are starting to hit around open banking, around wallets, and just complete, mobile penetration with Apple and Google. All right. So there's just all of these currents that are starting to form, and you can see that we're on the cusp of a lot of the changes, but it is not clear exactly how all these things are going to recombine.
The age of the fintech hyperscaler is here, and it's not clear how that it's going to play out, but it's fascinating that the tech trends are coming. I also think it's fascinating that it's temporarily a really good time to be an incumbent, and your reaction to that could be to use that capacity to invest and make a difference, or it could be to kind of go, oh, okay, the threat's gone. We're good. Fintech went away. We can just keep doing what we're doing. And I think that would be dangerous because this is not going away.
And that's to say nothing of AI, right? We talk about how AI can automate labor, and you can take these markets that are small and make them even bigger because your software can do more work and therefore can charge more. That's great. Financial services, $30 trillion industry. Most of that is labor cost. And in financial services, AI agents can monetize in invisible ways. So I think the ability of agents within financial services to monetize is going to be stronger than a lot of other categories. So not only is financial services one of the largest, categories of economic activity, I think it's also the place where you can have the most scalable, defensible business models for agents. And that can simply be bundling them into some of these hyperscalers just to make them way more efficient, or it could be creating whole new products of things. So just the AI wave, I think, has more applicability and interest than, some of the other sectors, where it will get applied, which it will as well. And I'm excited about that too. But that's another huge area of opportunity.
I'm excited for 2025. I hope we get to do a lot more chatting about stuff. We'll be reacting to the stories. But it was fun doing a SciTalks FinTech Rex Reacts episode of Rex and Simon Talk FinTech. Thanks for having me, dude.
Yeah, thanks for coming. That was awesome. And thanks for all the work you did to put that together.
Thanks to Jeff as well. Shout out to those guys and Aperture and Sardine. So appreciate you, Rex. Thank you.
All right. Takes a village. Thanks, Simon. So that's a wrap for the state of fintech in 2025. I think after listening to Simon and I discuss some of the big trends, you can get a feeling for how we're on the cusp of so many interesting things starting to happen. And that's why I think fintech is going to be so exciting to pay attention to next year and beyond. If you like this conversation, Simon and I also do a weekly podcast where we talk about the biggest topics and happenings in fintech. And on this channel, I also interview some of the most important founders, operators, and investors working in and around fintech and financial services. So if that sounds interesting to you, feel free to like, subscribe. And until then, catch you next time.